Well, there was in the place where we lived an unusual excitement.
Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. The papyrus fragments used to translate the Book of Mormon were considered lost due to the Great Chicago Fire. Were they really lost? Were they burned up? Historian Dan Vogel will answer that question in just a moment. Hey, I just want to tell you, I've sent out transcripts for the Greg Prince and Melvin Johnson interview to all our subscribers. If you'd like to receive those, or if you'd like to have a transcript of my interview with Dan Vogel, please subscribe on my website. Click the yellow subscribe button at gospeltangents.com, and I'll send you the transcript for Dan Vogel as soon as it's available. Or if you'd like these, get those in right away. Now back to our conversation. Yeah, because I think the scrolls were eventually lost for a long time, 100 years maybe? Is that about right? No?
Okay. Yeah, it's about 100 years.
And then there was a...
57...
It was assumed they were...
Or 71, actually.
It was assumed they were destroyed in the Great Chicago Fire.
Yeah.
And then they were rediscovered when?
The museum, New York Metropolitan Museum, always they knew they had them, but it started becoming more known, and it was turned over in 1967, the scraps. What happened was is that to give it the history of the scrolls after this project is Joseph Smith had displayed them. He cut them into pieces and put them in picture frames, basically under glass. The end parts of the scrolls he cut off because they were deteriorating, flaking off, and he put them under glass. So on the Hor or Horus scroll, it was about 3 feet. This becomes a dispute also that I'll talk about later, but it was about 3 feet. It's about 4 inches wide. About 3 feet long.
Okay.
And it had facsimile one, then a portion that has like two columns of hieratic, another one, facsimile three, which is no longer with us, maybe another part before that, and maybe another part, a picture somewhere in the middle, but probably not. But 3 feet, Joseph Smith chopped off the first foot about, which is what we got now. And he glued them on to thick paper that had the blueprints for the Kirtland Temple on it. Mm. And he glued them, and they were, and the foot, it was a foot that broke off with facsimile one and the text. That was cut later after it was glued onto the paper, put under picture frames. Joseph Smith would show them in Nauvoo. The other part stayed intact, about 2 feet. Remember, it's like 4 inches and 2 feet long, about that.
Mm-hmm.
And that part probably got burnt in the Chicago Fire of 1871. So Joseph Smith, he also chopped up the Ta Sheret Men papyrus, Book of the Dead, into like 9 or more pieces. Not like that even, and just all over the place, glued it on the paper and to preserve it. Lucy would show the mummies and show the papyri to people. And she was really keen on it. And she kept them until she died in 1856. Soon as she died, I mean, not very long afterwards, Emma sells this stuff to this Combs. Jacob Combs? Anyway. So this guy buys a whole lot. And he sells them to the St. Louis Museum. And the St. Louis later sells them to the Chicago Museum, Woods Museum in Chicago. And the 1871 fire. And Joseph Smith III said they were there. And then there was a fire, and they assumed it all got destroyed. They didn't know that part of the collection was given to Combs's like servant or maid or whatever. I forget her name now. She had them, went to her daughter. She sold them to the museum, New York Metropolitan Museum.
Okay.
So they had these fragments, and the museum gave them back to the church, and that's all they have are these fragments. And some people try to say the actual Abraham scroll was burnt in the fire, not these things. The only problem with that is that, so for all these years, we've had these translation manuscripts with the characters in the column, mm-hmm. on the page and what looks like the translation.
Mm-hmm.
And when the fragments came out, the one that was attached to facsimile one, you could see that the first character came from the first part, the next character and next character. Now we know where the characters came from, except about six of them were fake, invented characters. And they happened to coincide with where the scroll is damaged and there's a missing part. So when you roll up the scroll and the worms start eat it through the roll and you unroll it, there's like these
missing parts.
Every time there's a missing part, Joseph Smith invents a character and puts it in there until he reaches a part where there's another one.
Oh, I see.
And he just keeps going for four lines. And that's where it ended in Kirtland. So one problem...
Yeah, because I know Hugh Nibley said, oh, well, we're missing these aren't the right scrolls.
Yeah, and they say that's the wrong characters. But you're going, and it's not a translation. Nobody knows why these characters are in the columns. There couldn't be so much English words per one character. Everything that he said is wrong. And it's been perpetuated by the current Egyptologist apologists. The first... The amount of translation is due to the comprehensiveness of the language. In December 1835, on Oliver Cowdery's article in The Messenger and Advocate, he said that language is very comprehensive. When you look at the alphabet and grammar, it has three pages that begins, the grammar, the bound grammar, has three pages in the beginning that explain that each line, each dot has a sentence almost, you know. And when you add up all these little parts, and it says, this is the character dissected, and then it takes each line, each dot, and gives it a translation in the grammar. I mean, if you're going to criticize it, you should at least know what they're claiming. So they claim that it's a comprehensive language, and they explain why you get so much from one character right there in the grammar. So... and they tried, Nibley tried to say, and the current apologists repeat it, that, oh, these characters in the column is just an exotic way of organizing all three documents so that they know where to go to each paragraph that's the same. The problem with that is that they really don't begin each paragraph. They get beginning each part of the translation. When you look really close, it's not a paragraph where each character appears. Sometimes the paragraphs are split right in the middle of a sentence and another character. Or there's a fragment of a sentence, just one, about five words to a character. So they're dividing the text up to line up with the characters. They're not arbitrarily put in there for decoration or an exotic way of organizing the paragraphs. It's very obvious. At the top of the third translation of the Book of Abraham, the one that has that one, three verses in the handwriting of W.W. Phelps. At the top says, translation of records that have been found in the catacombs of Egypt. And in the other column, character. So, and then Phelps takes the first character and numbers it 1. The second character numbers it 2. And then over here underlines like Chaldea 1, Abraham 2. You know, then there's a third character he wrote, which is a real elaborate one that is dissected in the alphabet. But it doesn't number it because it has a lot of parts. The other two just have one part. This one has a lot of parts. You'd be, you know, all over the place trying to match it up. But the translation next to it, if you look in the grammar and you find that character, that's the translation given that character. So another interesting thing is that the complete translation, the longest one, the one that has the first 3 characters. So if Warren Parrish and Frederick G. Williams were just making personal copies, why would they skip the first 3 verses? Well, they skipped the first 3 verses because it's already written by W.W. Phelps. And they're continuing. So what happens is, we can tell that this third group of pages, like 5 pages, 5 or 6, maybe 7 or 8, I don't know, I can't remember. But the one that starts in W.W. Phelps' handwriting, continues in Warren Parrish's handwriting, and goes all the way to verse 18 of chapter 2, the longest document, was originally in a book. Because when you look at the inside margin of all of them, there's like somebody took a razor blade and it exactly copies the angle of the cut and everything. And whoever did it very sloppily because they cut through some of the character on the top part. So they removed it from a book. So there was a grammar book and a translation book, exactly the same. And evidently, the translation book was the finalized translation. And what happens is, Frederick G. Williams, Warren Parrish wrote from Joseph Smith's dictation simultaneously. Parrish left, and Frederick G. Williams wrote another paragraph and stopped. And Parrish also left drawing one character without any translation, so which implies that the characters were being written as they were going. And he left before he could do the last paragraph. Then he copies this and probably uses Frederick G. Williams, copies it into the book without any changes, really, not a lot of editing or things going on. He standardizes some of the spellings of the gods and things, but which is another reason you can tell it's orally dictated, because when Frederick G. Williams and Warren Parrish were writing simultaneously, they spelt the god Elkanah or Elkanah. One spells it mostly Elkanah, and one spells it mostly Elkanah, which reflects Joseph Smith's New England non-rhotic accent, right? Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like the Wata.
I used to live in New Hampshire.
Wata. So,
you know, or in New Hampshire.
The idea. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Stuff like that. That's his accent. And because they're writing a weird name they never seen before, they had to guess.
Yeah.
So they had to guess. It gets standardized eventually, but when it gets published. But so that's another indication that not only are they making the same changes, but that it's being orally dictated. And things like this has been noticed. I should mention that Brent Metcalf was really on to this kind of stuff before I came around and started studying it myself. But anyway, so the longest one was in the finalized book. And there were 2 books, and the other two, were continuing W.W. Phelps's project. So if these two documents by Frederick G. Williams and Warren Parrish, we know Warren Parrish didn't become a scribe until October 29th, right? And so then the next opportunity is the 19th of November, when both of these guys are mentioned in Joseph Smith's journal as being together with Joseph Smith and then translating afterwards. This document at the top of these two documents also mention the fifth degree of the second part, which is an allusion to the grammar book. This is showing you the order in which they were created, not the reverse of what the apologist and Nibley and the other apologists want. And that this was oral. Also, we have evidence that it's an oral, like they would write for thee instead of ee, they would write the. Mm-hmm. Actually, you know, because it sounds the same. The gods, oh. They would write thee with two e's, you know. There's other indications of this. And so, also, the reverse translation theory doesn't work because the alphabets really aren't a precursor to the Book of Abraham. Neither is the grammar. The alphabets, there's alphabets being written in July, according to the History of the Church entry. The alphabets have five parts. And some apologists try to say, oh, five parts, those are the five columns in next to facsimile one, Abraham on the altar being sacrificed. There's columns this way. There's three, two, and two. And then the other columns, the words read this way. And so in the next part of the scroll, the words are written from right to left, like that. And over on the facsimile, there's columns up and down, and they said there's five of them, so that must be the five parts. They don't bother checking their theory because it's not true at all. There's part one is from those valuable discovery notebooks about, I mean, you read the content, Princess Ketuman. And it says, and Princess Ketuman, or a female of the royal lineage, the daughter of Ham, discovered Egypt while it was still underwater. So it's trying to explain why Abraham and Joseph have records that are found on Egyptian mummies, right? So, and it explains that they have a right to the records, to have the records. But Egypt was, even though this is being translated from characters that are from the Amenhotep papyrus, not the Book of Breathings, not the Book of the Dead, but the Amenhotep papyrus that is copied in the valuable discovery notebooks with some invented characters. And the one invented character is the one about Egypt being discovered underwater. So it's talking about the Egyptians and that they come from Ham, the daughter of Ham, and Egypt was discovered by a woman while it was still underwater. Well, this ends up in the Book of Abraham. But that's not the origin of those paragraphs in the Book of Abraham. It just so happens that Joseph Smith invented a character that's sort of like a character that does appear in some of, it is an actual Egyptian character in a way, but it has three parts. But it doesn't occur in the record that supposedly came from Abraham. It occurs in the gap. So right in the Abraham, when they're copying characters off and it gets to the gap and there's invented characters, And they're like, there are actually three characters, kind of a group of a character, that run over the margin. So because these characters run over the margin of the translation documents, shows you that the scribes being particular, if they were just decorations, there's no need to run over the margin into the English. They're trying to keep the correct character in the correct place. Right? So it's inconvenient. The margin's not big enough, but if it's decoration or just a way to organize, you know, they could have just used numbers or alphabet or something, but they use the Egyptian characters. They would have just used one character. Why slop over into the margin, out of the margin? Anyway, so the character that Joe Smith invents ends up as part of the character. The character he invents in the alphabets and gives the definition for underwater is part of the three characters that appears over here in the translation documents for the part in the Book of Abraham that talks about Egypt being discovered by the daughter of Ham while it was still underwater, and her name was Egyptus, right? Anyways, quite clear that part one deals with the mummies, not Abraham, but even though part of it somehow ends up over there. Part two, people have already noticed that it matches the pure language sample, that there's like six or seven characters from a letter that W.W. Phelps wrote his wife on the 26th of May, 1835, a couple of months before the Book of the papyri were purchased in Kirtland. So in May, before July, right? W.W. Phelps write a sample of the pure language to his wife and gives about six characters and definitions. And it says, you know, all man for God, you know, son all man for Jesus, you know, sons all man for mankind, you know. Well, the words come from 1832, from a definition that Joseph Smith gave in 1832 of the Adamic language.
Oh.
Right? So it's part of the pure language, the Adamic language, which they associated with tongues. You know, the early Mormons associated with tongues. That Joe Smith said Brigham Young was speaking the Adamic language and then spoke some himself. And some other members, you know, like Elizabeth and Whitney, spoke in tongues, and he said that was the Adamic language and that you would never lose that gift.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with historian Dan Vogel. In our final conversation with Dan, we'll talk about his critique of apologetic arguments about the Book of Abraham. But it's only available to newsletter subscribers. To subscribe to our free newsletter, go to gospeltangents.com/newsletter, and I will send you a secret link only available to newsletter subscribers. So if you don't want to miss the last segment, check it out. And by the way, it's free. And here's what we're going to talk about in our next conversation.
This is just a variation of what Nibley first tried, actually. He tried to say, oh, the red writing, there's no red writing on it. And Mike Marquardt wrote a response after he said that, Cowdery's describing both records together, you know, that they're beautifully written in a black ink and a part in red ink, which the scroll that was identified as Joseph has red ink things here and there all over the place.
If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please support Gospel Tangents and become a subscriber. For just $5 a month, go to patreon.com/gospeltangents and you can hear the entire interview. And you can also get transcripts available at either our Amazon website, or if you want to give the money to me and not Amazon, please subscribe on my website at gospeltangents.com. And you can click the yellow subscribe button. Of course, we're also on Facebook, Twitter, and all the other places. Make sure you subscribe on iTunes at tinyurl.com/gospeltangents. And don't forget to click here to subscribe on YouTube, here for a transcript, and over here we've got some more of our great videos. Thanks again for listening.